Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. We've got loads of announcements today, but before we get on to those, let's get straight into talking about some modern history. Now, today, the thing I particularly want to talk about is Britain's interests in the Eastern Mediterranean in the mid to late 19th century, what could be called the Eastern Question. Now, normally, Britain and the Eastern Question relates to the crisis that the British government and opposition have thrown into over Russia, Turkey and the Balkans in from 1878 onwards. But the Eastern Question for me goes back far further than that. And I think it really goes back to the mid-19th century, the Crimean War and Anglo-Russian rivalries over India. In many ways, the question over the East has been one that has dominated everything since 1815 and the Congress of Vienna. There seems in 19th century political discourse in Britain to be this innate antipathy towards autocratic Russia. Britain had a series of reform acts throughout the 19th century, 1832, 1867 and 1884, where the franchise is gradually increased and the country is democratised. In 1815, it was perhaps not as feudal as Russia. We don't have an institution like serfdom, but certainly not particularly democratic. But throughout the century, a process of democratic liberalisation occurs. And there is a much greater sense in Britain that rule of parliamentary law, a constitutional monarchy, and a greater progression towards civil rights and individual rights is really the correct direction in history. So there is this real antipathy and distrust of autocratic Russia. And we normally think of ourselves as having acute Anglo-German tensions within the late 19th century. And these are a really, really minor and short-lived phenomenon compared to the antipathy that Britain has towards Russia and the number of times where Britain does go to war with Russia and is prepared to go to war with Russia. And the real turnaround in sort of 1907, 1908, when a Anglo-Russian Entente is signed, is quite an enormous revolution in Anglo-Russian diplomatic affairs, and really totally overlooked. Anglo-French Entente Cordiale in 1904 is seen as being far more important, and Anglo-German relations, but the ability of Britain to forge a relationship with Russia in the half decade before World War I is quite extraordinary. And the reason for this is that Russia is not only seen as autocratic and undemocratic, but also there is some sort of ancient sense of barbaricness about Russia, about the Russian horde. And its ability perhaps to march into Europe when it sees fit. This is very useful during the Napoleonic Wars, of course, and really brings Napoleon to his knees. But there's an immense anxiety over Russia. And also Russia's ability to march and her constant march eastwards into what would be now seen as places like Kazakhstan and the former Soviet Central Asian republics, and the ability from there to threaten Afghanistan and thereby India. And these are the kinds of anxieties, really, that are responsible for the formulation of Britain's anti-Russian policy during the Crimean War. Britain looked upon the Ottoman Empire, sat to the south of Russia, that dominated the Balkans, Turkey, and the Middle East, the Arabian Peninsula, parts of North Africa, including Egypt. They looked upon the Ottoman Empire as being the lesser of two evils. The typical British imperial chauvinism looked upon the Ottomans as being little better than medieval despots, and a backward oriental kind of culture existing there that was really quite inferior, and again viewed as unjust, undemocratic, unfair, and unlawful. Though in many ways, none of these titles particularly apply to the Ottomans. The culture of the Ottoman Empire was far more diverse and advanced than British imperial chauvinism gave it credit for being. However, the Ottoman Empire had been weakening throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, and their hold over their imperial acquisitions had been in gradual decline, particularly Egypt, which had become almost a self-ruling province within the Ottoman Empire, and also over the Balkans, particularly Serbia, who had once again had become this sort of self-ruling suzerain within the empire, and would gradually come to cause the Ottomans ever greater degrees of trouble. Throughout the 19th century, the designs of Russia over the Balkans and the desire of the Russians to meddle internally within the Ottoman Empire come from two sources. Firstly, whenever Russian czars appeared particularly weak or ineffectual or struggled to control their own people, they dealt with periodic rebellions in the countryside, normally as the result of famines. The projection of Russian power abroad became far more important and essential. The Russian people could at least rally behind a nationalist figurehead who would be restoring Russian pride. Russian pan-Slavic ideas, the idea that the Tsar was the Tsar protector of all Orthodox and Slavic peoples, particularly those of the Balkans, drove Russian foreign policy to meddle in that region throughout the 19th century, and the Balkans is obviously the part of the Ottoman Empire. The other prong of Russian anti-Ottoman policy is again the Tsar's desire to protect Orthodoxy, and particularly the holy places within the Ottoman Empire that cover the sites of the Orthodox Church. So aspects of the old Byzantine Empire that was the birthplace of Orthodoxy, of which, of course, Constantinople, known as Istanbul, was its epicentre. But within Jerusalem as well, holy Christian sites were especially sought after as places where the Russians could exercise power and could project their own military and religious authority over, to extend some kind of protection to them, and thus really kind of make them Orthodox sites. And we are talking about some of the most fundamental locations of the Christian faith. The wider goal of Russia within the Ottoman Empire was really to bring the Ottomans to their knees and to make the Ottoman Empire not necessarily annexed by Russia, but a puppet state that the Tsar of Russia could use to his advantage. Now, this didn't suit the British. Any expansion into the Balkans by the Russians or any control over the Ottoman Empire not only meant that India was came under greater threat, but it also meant that the routes to India came under greater threat. Now, by this point, by the time of the Crimean War, the Suez Canal hasn't been created. However, the Sinai Peninsula is still a very important route to the British. It really is very inconvenient to have to go around the Cape of Good Hope, and instead the British sail to Egypt and cross the Sinai using wagon trains and all sorts, all means of conventional transport to the other side, and then sail on. And in the other direction, that's how goods reach Britain, particularly cotton. So having the Russians have a presence in the Ottoman Empire would be very, very bad for business. The other problem that the Russians present to the British is by controlling the Balkans, they would shut off access for the British to the Danube, and British trading ships made huge sums of money by sailing up and down the Danube and trading in that fashion. In fact, the number two market for all British goods was indeed the Ottoman Empire. So preventing Britain from accessing the Ottoman Empire would have been very, very disadvantageous to the British, and something that they were not willing to accept. Now, the situation is complicated in April 1876 by an uprising against the weak.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Weakening Ottoman authorities in Bulgaria. The Bulgarians, for a month, from April to May, managed to revolt successfully against the Ottomans. But the suppression of the revolt is one of the great sort of war crimes of the 19th century. The Ottomans employ their bashi bazooks, their mercenaries, a kind of, I suppose, akin to Britain's Black and Tans in Ireland, to engage in a campaign of terror in Bulgaria to put down the revolt. An American journalist for the Times contacted the head office in London and ran a series of stories about the horrors of the Balkans, which seemed to really capture Britain's public imagination. Benjamin Disraeli, the Prime Minister of the day, was a pro-Ottoman supporter, not out of any love for the Ottoman Empire, but out of a belief that really the Russians were the greater threat, and it was expedient for the British to prop up the Ottomans in order to keep the Russians out. William Gladstone, the leader of the opposition, a high-minded moralist of the First Order, though ironically when he comes to power in 1880, winds up in all sorts of unfortunate imperial entanglements. William Gladstone leads a campaign against this cynicism, as he sees it, against Britain's support for the atrocities against the good Christian peoples of Bulgaria by the Muslim horde, in his view. And he's very successful. Of course, it's the Midlothian campaign, which is he was campaigning really for the seat of what would now be Edinburgh, but the seat of Midlothian. And he really whips up an immense amount of angst against Disraeli's government. Here's a little extract of something that Gladstone wrote in 1876. He said, "The details of these abominations may be read in published reports, now known to be accurate in the main. They are hardly fit for reproduction. The authors of the crimes are the agents, the trusted and sometimes and the since promoted servants of the Turkish government. The moral and material support which during the year had been afforded to the Turkish government has been given by the government of England on behalf of the people of England. In order to a full comprehension of the practical question at issue, it will be necessary to describe the true character and position of the Turkish power and the policy, as I think it is questionable and erroneous policy of the British government." At the end of the Crimean War, with the siege of Sevastopol, the Russians had been forced to surrender and had been forced to sign a treaty that prohibited them from using the Black Sea. The Russians had sought a warm water port throughout most of the 19th century because it was virtually impossible to operate a large fleet from somewhere like Kronstadt, which was frozen over for half the year, or Vladivostok, which suffered the same. So a warm water port on the Black Sea and access, hopefully, to the Mediterranean was really the Holy Grail. And Russia spies an opportunity in the Balkan outrages to get what she wants. The Russians prosecute a war against the Ottomans, ostensibly in defence of their Slavic Orthodox brothers, but really in defence of Russia's own interests. And they defeat the Ottomans successfully. And the price that Russia demands is a large Bulgarian state carved out of former Ottoman territories in the Balkans, and this large Bulgarian state will be a protectorate of Russia, really a Russian colony. It'll have a large part of the Adriatic coastline. No, I beg your pardon, not the Adriatic, the Aegean. Sorry, my bad. The Aegean coastline. And this will enable the Russians to use warm water ports along the Aegean and have access to the Mediterranean, and then, now that the Suez Canal has been dug, if they choose to cut the British off from Suez, which would make it almost inevitable that the British would lose India if the Russians did decide to attack or decide to foment revolution in India. So this is intolerable to the British. And it's also intolerable to the Austrians, who have their own interests in the Balkans, and they do not wish to see the fermentation nationalism within the Balkans and the creation of nation states, which could have huge implications for the Austrian Empire. So these two powers decide that they will threaten war if this issue isn't resolved. And in order to prevent a wider European war, Bismarck, the German Chancellor, who doesn't wish to see his Russian and Austrian allies come to blows and for him to be dragged in on one side or the other, calls a Congress in Berlin in 1878, which is attended by Disraeli, and it is attended by Lord Salisbury, his deputy. And the two of them have a gay old time in Berlin. There are many banquets and booze-ups and lots of backroom deals. And Disraeli comes away with a promise that Russia will only be allowed a small Bulgaria, and it will not have access to the sea, and the British are triumphant. The Russians are enormously angered and humiliated by this, and it really eventually leads up to the breakup of German relations with Russia and Austria. The Russians withdraw from the League of Three Emperors. And the emphasis of Russian policy after 1878 is to project eastwards. One of the long-term results of Britain's triumph over the Eastern Question and the use of the Congress system within Europe and European diplomacy to put paid to Russian ambitions is that Russia eventually expands further east, and the Tsars following Alexander II and Nicholas II become more interested in places like Korea, Manchuria, and they eventually wind up treading on Japan's toes. So the disputes between Japan and Russia that eventually culminate in the Russo-Japanese War are there because the Russians have no ability to expand their borders in the West or expand their influence in the West, particularly in the Balkans. And following the Russo-Japanese War, where does the emphasis of Russian policy shift back to? Back to the Balkans. So between 1904 and 1914, the Balkans once again become an area of great interest to the Russians. Now, of course, that's quite a simplified version of the Eastern question, but I think it's a pretty good one. Okay, so I hope that's been useful for you today. Now, I've got a load of announcements. Firstly, there's new stuff on the Explaining History YouTube channel, so go there now and subscribe. I'm putting on new videos every single day. They're ideal for, particularly for students, but I'm putting stuff on for non-students and enthusiasts and people that just love modern history. So go there. If you go to www.explaininghistory.com, you can click through, there's a link on the front page, you can click through there to the Explaining History podcast. Subscribe and I'll keep you updated with not just podcasts here, but video there. And there's tons of stuff about how to tackle practical problems like essays and that kind of stuff. So please make sure you subscribe to that. Coming soon, we've got Penguin Books sending me some new review titles. So hopefully we're going to have some real quality material to talk over and to give you some help on. And finally, at the end of the month, the first Explaining History study course is going to be launched online. So this is going to be really, really good. It's going to help you with an awful lot. The first study course is going to be on Russia and the causes of the Russian Revolution. So it's going to be everything I've done over the past 20 years, all the teaching, all the tutoring, writing and learning I personally have done, compiled into about 6 hours that are going to take you from wherever you're at in your studies to outstanding marks. I'm going to show you simple strategies that I use to help students excel and get top grades, and I'm going to show you how they're quite easy to replicate. So I'm going to take a lot of the mystery out of getting top marks in history and make it really, really simple and straightforward for you. Okay, so I'm going to be launching it on the 1st of October, and there's going to be a special introductory price for everybody that follows Explaining History. Thereafter, it kind of will go up because, I got to pay the mortgage, got a kid on the way, that kind of thing. So make sure that you follow the link on the 1st of October to get the special introductory price. It'll be cheap as chips, absolute bargain. And thereafter, I'll be adding new material to the audio and video course every single month. So the deal just gets better and better. Anyway, keep a lookout for all these things, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much. Bye bye.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford Tough, Built Ford Proud.